Thank you for the introduction. Are there any questions? Can you all hear me clearly, or do I need to use a microphone? Microphone? Okay. I want to introduce you to a lady who was very nervous about having children. The other mic. Very funny. How am I going to walk around with this one?
I don't know.
What? I'll tell you what. I'm going to project my voice, and if it doesn't work, you'll let me know. I'll go behind the... I want to introduce you to a lady who was so nervous about having children that when she revealed her fear to the doctor, he said, you know, tell me, what is the matter? Why are you so scared? And he said, look, I'll be very honest with you. I just don't want that my child should be disrespectful to me, be defiant. I just couldn't handle it. I see my friends, what they go through. I just couldn't go through it. He says, you know, it's very interesting that you mention this because recently we've completed research on a new pill which guarantees your child will turn out polite. She says, really? So yeah, absolutely. But you must follow the instructions exactly as prescribed. So she promises this and that. And he gives her the prescription, and she takes it religiously. She becomes pregnant. 8 months into pregnancy, everything's going fine. You know, she says to herself, you know, I can't take a risk. I'm so anxiety-ridden. And she ups the dosage, instead of one a day, to four a day. And 9 months come by, the due date, and she's still out there. 10 months, 11 months, 12 months. Now she's in all the journals across America. 14 months, a year, 2 years. Nothing's coming out. She dies 92 years old, and the doctors refuse to have her buried until they open her up. And sure enough, inside her womb are two old men, long white beards, going, after you, no, after you, no, after you, no, after you. Parenting is a very electric subject because you and I are so invested in our children. You know, they're an extension of us. We know that when our child behaves well, that's my child. When our child doesn't behave well, that's not my child. I remember once in Citibank, my four-year-old, my wife was busy that day. I had to take care of him. I don't know what. I'm not good with diapers. And it just fell apart right online, not the internet, in Citibank. And there I am, and I say, you know what, this is the last time I'm taking my neighbor's child out first. When our child does something right, we are so invested that somehow when they do the right thing, it makes us proud. And when they're not, especially in public, we feel shame. What is this really about? Forgive me for sounding a little morbid, but imagine lying in one's coffin, listening to the speeches that our children are giving about how mom and dad was in their lifetime. Now, many of us had the privilege of writing our child's bat mitzvah speech or bar mitzvah speech, but not many of us are going to get the opportunity to write the speech that our kids are going to say about us on our funeral day. What do we want our children to say of us? What do we want them to be saying on our funeral? Let's project ourselves a little bit further. Imagine we're in our 50s, 60s, and we're describing our child, now 35 years old. What would we like to say about our 35-year-old child? This is my boy. What description do we want to be able to say, this is my kid? What description should we want to give? Any suggestions?
Loving.
He's very loving, very affectionate, giving. What else? He's happy. Oh, that's so important. We want our child to be loving and happy. We want to be able to say our child is a happy person. What else?
Independent.
Wow. That's right. That usually happens around about 35, 40, right? Okay, we want our kid to be independent. In fact, the real goal of parenting, Jewish parenting specifically, but parenting in general, is really to give and to give and to give until they can give to themselves. So independency is very powerful. In what areas do we want them to be independent?
Financially.
We want them to be financially independent. Okay. So we've got emotionally independent. We want them to be emotionally strong. So we've got happiness. We've got love. Financial independence. Emotional independence. What else do we want to be able to say about a 35-year-old son or daughter?
They have children.
They're building their own family. and their children are happy and healthy. What else do we want to say? He's a doctor. Okay. He's a doctor. You have to have one. Okay. He's a committed Jew. Always get one religious fanatic in the audience. He's a committed Jew. He wants to be, he's someone who goes to synagogue and has Jewish values, follows Jewish rituals. Very good. He developed, worked on himself, and through that he's grown to become stronger through different adversity and situations which really tested his inner strength, and he had some ups and downs, but he pulled through in the end. So we want him to develop his inner strength. Excellent. To be like me. You mean like you or like me? I don't know you so well. Okay, so to be like you, which means? What do you like about you? Oh, you want, good. You want, what you would have real nachas, real pleasure, is to see your kid following the same values as you. Not out of fear, because out of love, if he's following the same values, you must have done a good job. Yes, madam. Menschlich. We want him to be respectful, kind, a mensch in society. Whoever meets him says, you know what, I want to tell you about your son. He is such a mensch. Ah, oh, that's my son. Right? Good. Anything else? God should be happy with him. Okay, I never heard that one before. Alright, God should be happy with him. That's a difficult one to figure out till the final score, but I just a good one. How do we know? Yeah. Oh, so he should follow the words. Okay. Very good. So he should be someone who's dedicated to the Torah and to Jewish life, is what you're saying. He should be committed so that God has pleasure from him. Fine. Very good. We've got a long list here. I'm going to suggest the following. I've got one more person here. One more.
That he honors his parents.
He honors his parents. Very good. That he loves, honors, and cherishes his parents. That will surely give us a tremendous amount of pleasure. No question about it. I want to suggest the following. We are very invested in our children, and we have here a long list of what we want. And it's clear to us. We want them to be happy, loving, healthy, financially independent, emotionally independent, respectful of their parents, with religious, strong religious values to go into in the ways of their parents, if the parents are going in good ways. So, we've got a long list here over here. I want to suggest a 4-point plan for building a business. We're going to create a model tonight, and we're going to have 4 points to this model plan, which is a business plan. The business, of course, is parenting, but we're going to pretend it's a real business. And that is, first of all, number one, let's know what is the product we are selling to our customers. Our customers, of course, our children. What are the products, the values? What are the products that we are selling to our children? So we've got happiness, we've got health, we've got emotional strength, we've got personal growth, we have financial independence. These are some of the jars or items, the products on the shelves in our store, in our home, that we are selling to our customer, our child. That's number one, which we want to look at. Number two, let's know the customer. Different strokes for different folks. Is there anyone in this room who has two children exactly the same? You can discipline them the same way. No way! Totally different. So it's evident that what works for one child will not necessarily work for the other. So we really have to be on our toes. They're going to really work us. Number three, in building a serious business, how important is it to know our competition? If you have real competition out there and they are selling the same products as you're trying to sell, and they have perhaps a much larger budget for selling their product than you and I have to communicate the value of our product to our child, to our customer, how are we going to deal with the competition? We have to look seriously at our competition. Because is it possible if we don't know what our competition is and how powerful they are, that our children, even after they've tasted our products, will buy someone else's version, which might have artificial flavoring, artificial ingredients, artificial coloring, immediate gratification? How can we be sure that they'll want to come back to our store and buy our product after they've tasted someone else's on college campus or a roommate's version or in someone else's home, where we don't have the same control? So the fourth part of the presentation will be, how do we so successfully, so powerfully communicate the value of the product which we are selling in our store to our customer, so that not if, but when they taste other people's products under the same name of happiness and love, and it might not be your version of freedom and independence, they taste it and say, you know something? The one I bought in that store is the original version. It's real. It works. How can we so powerfully communicate with absolute clarity that this version will be so good, so clear, that no matter where they go, no matter how far they are from our store, they will keep coming back? And what will be the greatest nachas, the greatest pleasure of all? The greatest pleasure of all, this gentleman over here, your name, sir? Jack? He hit on the money. Jack knows the answer to this question. The greatest pleasure of all is when they grow up, our customer goes and opens up a franchise. And he opens up the same business, marries and has children, and when you go to his store, he's selling the same product with the same ingredients. Ah, now you know you did a real good job. This is the four-part plan. So let's look, first of all, at the products. What are we selling to our children? Well, you've given us some ideas. Imagine over here, you've got on the shelves of your home, in your store, and your kid comes in, Mom, I need a quick and fast dose of love. A lot of it. I'm going through such a hard time. Listen, son, can't you see I'm going through such a difficult time with the management right now? Just leave me alone. I haven't got enough to give you. Can we afford a situation where we're out of stock of love? Or must we have a large jar of love at all times, ready for supply, no matter what's going on in our personal lives, ready for this customer? And what's going to be in the ingredients of our love? What's real love? I never forget when I was a teenager, I went to a very interesting school. I went to the most progressive school in Europe. I'm not going to go into too many details. It was co-ed at the 19th century, the turn of the 19th century. It was co-ed. We called teachers by the first name, and there was no uniform. This is Victorian England. You can imagine what it was in the 60s, 70s. So I just want to share with you, those are very interesting people in my school. Albert Finney, his son, was in my class. You've heard of Stanley Kubrick? You probably remember Stanley Kubrick. I can say some of your faces here, they know the old days. Stanley Kubrick's daughter was in my class. Turn this off a moment. Her name was Anya. She had a crush on me. Anyway. Paul McCartney's daughter was the class below. I'm telling you this not to impress you, because I want you to know where I'm coming from when I share some interesting examples about the competition that we are up against. Ringo Starr, he had a kid in our school as well. His name is Zach. He was 4 years old at the time. Today he's in and out of rehab across America. He's quite famous in our prisons. And at that time, I remember coming in late one morning to school, and I saw Ringo Starr. He was dragging his feet along the ground, never picked them up, and he had a long sheepskin coat, and I went up to him. He was about up to here on me. I wasn't that tall, 16, and he was wearing, you know, the platforms and high heels that came back into fashion now. And I went up to him, and I said, Ringo, can I have your autograph? And he said two words to me. The second word was off. The first word contained four letters. No, it wasn't love. And I said to myself, you know, I don't understand. This guy, you know, there he is. He's drumming away. All you need is love. Yeah, 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 yeah. You don't know the first thing of decency. Tell me your therapist says you can't sign any more signatures. Your whole career's in your wrist. But to say these two words, I'm a teenager. I love the Beatles. You could have crushed and destroyed my ego. And it got me wondering, what's real love? Where are we supposed to go for... when we sell love to our kids, what version, what ingredients do we want in that jar? I never forget, getting sidetracked on love for a moment. Would you agree that Liz Taylor is one of the most adored people in the world? True or false? She's loved by millions, if not tens of millions of people. Absolutely true, right? On one occasion, my father was revoicing a film, and she had to come in to redo her part. Dubbing... revoicing means an actor or an actress might have a cold, for example, and you're not going to just wait till the cold goes away. You still have to film that shot. And then when you redo the film in the studio, the soundtrack, you have to call in the actor to revoice his or her part when they've lost the cold. Or sometimes they're on an another location. Now you have to call in a different actor to do their voice without them knowing. So Liz Taylor was called in to revoice a part in the film, and she was literally carried in 2 hours after the studio had already been booked. And they could not get a word out of her. She was stone drunk. Why? That night, said the porter who brought her, she was in the Ritz Hotel, no less, she'd been drinking, ordering drinks from 3 a.m. She got off the phone to Richard Burton. At that time, she was on her third marriage to him. Gave him a lot of chances. And it didn't work out, and she was drinking the rest of the night. She was totally out of control. Just over a year ago, she was interviewed after a successful tumor was removed from her brain, and she was asked, amongst many questions, Liz, could you tell me, what do you think of Sean Connery? Oh, she said, Sean Connery, he can put his slippers beneath my bed any night of the week. Is Miss Sean Connery here? No. Shoo. Liz, you know, I don't understand. You're adored by so many millions of people, don't you see? You've been through, do you know how many marriages? How many marriages has Liz been through?
Eight.
It's nine, thank you, man. On the last count, it's nine marriages. You have so much experience to call upon, so much clarity. Every time you speak about love, people are going to listen. What pearls of wisdom are you going to share with us? What is she saying as a statement about loyalty in a relationship? Do we want to have a jar of loyalty, or at least have loyalty under the ingredients of love? So what is real love? And when our kid goes and sees the version that's sold in the outside world of the movies and commercials, how are they supposed to make a clear distinction between when love is real and when love is not real? How about happiness? One lady here mentioned happiness. We want a big jar of happiness. What do we want as some of the ingredients on our happiness jar? Any suggestions? Happiness is whose responsibility?
Self-awareness.
My own self-awareness. I have to be responsible for my happiness. But is it possible, if our child goes elsewhere, they might get a different version? Now tell me if you know anyone who relates to this. You know what? When I get out of high school, you cannot believe, when I finish high school, I'm going to be so happy. You know, when I get my first relationship, I'm going to be so happy. When I get out of that relationship, I'm going to be so happy. You know, when I get married, I'm going to be so happy. When I get divorced, I'm going to be so happy. And when I have children, I'm going to be so, when I get children out of the house, I'm going to be so happy. Wait a minute. If happiness is outside of me, who controls my happiness? If happiness is not my responsibility, you have to respect me more and show me more appreciation. And my dear boss, when you understand how much I'm busting my tail for you, then I'll really exert myself in this job. If I make others responsible for my happiness, how much effort am I going to employ to make happiness my responsibility? Is it possible that every single commercial that our children see works on the assumption, I cannot possibly be happy until I'm on this diet? Or wearing this hair cream, perhaps not in my case. Until I'm driving this car. Is it possible that happiness is being sold as something that's outside of me? And therefore, it's not my fault I'm not happy. I'm not responsible to figure out what's already good in my life. And that becomes the basis and training for enjoying more when it comes into my life. So we've got a number of items on these jars here. How are we supposed to so clearly communicate to our children what's real happiness, real love? Financial responsibility. That's a powerful one. Is it true that in this country, financial stress is partially responsible and correlated to the two biggest diseases, the two biggest killers in this country? Mark Hexted, in his report to the Senate on fitness and health, claims that there's mounting evidence and medical research which suggests, and in some cases proves, that heart disease and cancer, two biggest killers in this country, are correlated to lifestyle, diet, and financial stress. If we had a choice to say, I want my kid to be abundantly wealthy, or I want my kid to be principled and very responsible in money management, which would we prefer of the two? And which of the two is probably going to lead to more stability, security in finances, maintaining wealth, and probably building it as well? We know the answer. We'd love our children to have abundance of money, but if they wouldn't be financially responsible, will it help enough? 87%, I don't know what it's like out here in Columbus, but 87% of those who win New York lotteries have lost their money within 10 years. Why? Family feuds, financial responsibility, trusting the wrong people, investing in all sorts of places. So financial responsibility is a very heavy one. What would you see as probably the most important financial ingredient we want on our financial responsibility jar that we're selling to our customers? What would be number one principle?
Honesty,
integrity in the workplace. That's an important one. Any others? Understanding the value of money. Absolutely. And a result of that will be spending less than one earns. Wow. Now, I don't know if anyone can relate to this, but some of you probably have friends who get in the mail every single day the following invitation. You have been pre-approved, madam, for $25,000 additional credit. And if you apply before January 31st, you will be able to get a special rate of 5.9% above prime rate in small print. Are you interested? Well, in this country, what has happened? 20, 30 years ago, you and I know that our parents' generation, if they didn't have cash, or if their cash flow, their earnings, or unearned earnings, did not pay enough for something they wanted, what did they do? You did without. You saved. You waited. You budgeted. Today, a combination of three or four credit cards, I can have access to any number of luxuries, vacations, cars, even home extensions, improvements that our parents and grandparents did not have. What is a credit card in reality? Close, getting close, very warm, borrowing. It's really, what is a credit card? It's a debt card. So over here in our financial jar, it's going to say, spend less than you earn and invest the difference in your own future, an IRA account, a pension plan. And over here, what happens if our kid goes next door and says, wow, if I buy on credit, I can have things which I can't afford. Ah! Now, actually, it's really a debt card. Now, let's call it what it really is. Madam, you have been pre-approved for $50,000 additional debt over and above all other debts you presently have. And if you apply before January the 31st, you will get a special rate of 5.9% interest over and above prime rate. Sign here. How many people are going to apply for credit? It's not a credit card. In fact, what did the media do when they discovered that life insurance really was not selling? Do you know the original name for life insurance? Death insurance. Thank you. What was life insurance originally known as? Death insurance. Now imagine someone comes up to your door in the days when it was safe. Yes, what are you doing? I'm selling death insurance and accessories. Are you interested? Death insurance, no, thank you very much. So they changed it to life insurance. It's all a play on words. But how will our child know the difference between secure investments and risky ones? And whose responsibility is it to teach them? Well, we've got that special advantage that they come to our store as much as 24 hours a day. Of course, they're out in school, part of it, but they're in our school for the, in our store, they visit, they sleep over in our store for the first 18 years. We have a tremendous advantage. So we want to sell them financial responsibility before they find out the plastic version of artificial wealth. How many people do we know whose lives are under incredible stress because of service debt that they are paying over and above their income just to be able to float the interest payments? So how are we going to pass that on to our kid when there's so much sales pitch out there? Health. Oh, there's so much information about health on those jars. It's confusing. How are we supposed to be clear on what's healthy? Of course we want to be role models. That's the most powerful mode of communication. So what's going to be on our ingredients of healthy living? Diet, exercise. So we know that whatever they're going to see in the store that the management is doing, saying, thinking, our values are who we are, and that's what we're selling to our kids. Let's move on to the competition. Very important. Who is the major competition that we are up against in this business selling these products? Who else is selling the same products? Love, happiness, success, pleasure, responsibility, discipline. The peers, major pressure. Who else? Drug dealers. Okay. The media. How powerful would you say is the media in influencing our children, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10? Thank you. Broke the scale. The media is very powerful. I'm going to share with you a few examples taken from the world of advertising. My father's done a lot of commercials. He used to employ me to do voiceovers in various commercials. I'll tell you a quick one that was done many years ago. I was 11 years old. For Bird's Eye fish fingers. Now, fish fingers in England are fish sticks here, right? And the commercial went something like this. Mommy, mommy, before my voice was broken. Mommy, mommy, did you know that there's as much protein in one fish finger, one fish stick, than a can of baked beans? Now, I don't know if you have in this country, but in England, we had a commercial called Beans Means Heinz. And guess who sued us? One fish stick has more protein than a can of baked beans? Heinz. So we were sued by Heinz Baked Beans. A few weeks later, they called me in and redid the commercial. Mommy, mommy, did you know there's as much protein in one fish finger as in a packet of pork sausages? Now, everyone in England knows that pork sausages is synonymous to the manufacturer called Wool's. Wool's pork sausages. They're the biggest. And we were sued by Wool's. They called me back a few weeks later and did it all over again, this time to British Farm Eggs, who themselves were going through financial problems, so they were unlikely to sue us. 11 years old, I said to my father, Daddy, you know, I don't understand. They pay me every time I come in. Why can't they just get it right the first time? I said, you don't understand. They've already calculated that before it comes off the air, because the commercial's in legal arbitration, they've made enough sales bad-mouthing the other companies. It's worth it to them. Now let me share with you from the inside of how advertising works. There may be some of you who are in advertising yourselves. You can help me along over here. But I'm just going to share with you what I learned from Saatchi and Saatchi. And this is how advertising is really done. And it's the same formula that works in every still photo in a magazine, every movie that has commercials, every television that has commercials and advertisements. And the formula is the following. It's horribly simple, frighteningly simple. Researchers, actually psychologists and therapists, are hired to identify all the national hang-ups in society. Every negative emotion that exists is listed on a long page. Depression, anxiety, feeling alone, feeling ugly, feeling unloved, feeling not successful, feeling not getting ahead in my career, not having job satisfaction, not getting along with my father-in-law, not getting along with my parents, feeling too big, too fat. Long, long list. Very depressing. Then, a very simple list, the solutions. You feel unloved, we'll tell you you're loved. You're ugly, you're beautiful. We'll find a solution for every problem. Now, how do you sell the product? Very frighteningly simple. After depicting the exact target audience based on four criteria, age, gender, social status, financial status, the advertising agency, having depicted in the commercial whichever emotional, negative emotion that they want the target audience to relate to, then powerfully associates the product to the solution. One doesn't have anything to do with the other. So this is the formula. I'll give you an example. In England, I'm sorry I'm not here long enough to give you too many American examples. I'll give you one or two later. In England, we have a commercial produced by British Telecom. You've heard of British Telecom? They're the AT&T of Britain, and it's spilling over into Europe. It's a very good product. I'm not knocking products. But this is the manipulation that you will see behind the commercial. And they came up with a commercial they called The Hunchback of Notre Dame. And those of you who read the book, some of your friends saw the Disney version, but this is how it goes. You see the hunchback in the tower in total panic. He is beside any moment now, this murderous mob with bloodshot eyes marching down this cobbled street with fiery torches flamed in their hands, screaming, "Kill!" Oh, sorry, I woke you up, sorry. "Kill him! Kill him!" And you see this poor, ugly creature inside the tower. I'm sorry, spraying you over there. You see, no one's in the front row because of that, right? Any moment now, they're going to arrive at the entrance to the tower and they're going to burn and tear this creature apart. And just before they arrive, the phone goes. This is 400 years ago. That's how it rings in England. And the hunchback pulls off the receiver off the wall. And on the other end of the line goes the following voice. 16-year-old female. "I love you. I love you." And he pulls the receiver away from his face. And he says, "Love." And the entire mob was about to murder this creature, stop short of the entrance, and scream out in perfect unison with smiles across their faces, "She loves you! She loves you!" And just before the end of the commercial, across the screen goes the following caption in a British accent, which I can do quite well. "If you want to be loved by someone, buy British Telecom." End of commercial. $250,000 commercial. Now, is there anyone in this room who is really outraged and angered by that commercial? Or are you basically entertained? And I didn't do as well as the real version. Anyone outraged? No. Let's go to the script writing room where they created this commercial and ask them, now, what was going on in their minds when they put this together? Do they really think the British are so shallow, unintelligent, they're going to buy... No, don't ask that question. According to our statistics, Mr. 18-year-old plus, oh my gosh, so ugly. You wake up in the morning, you see yourself in the mirror. Oh, we saw your pain. Who's ever going to want to have a relationship with you? So ugly. Who's ever going to marry you? We decided to come up with $250,000 commercial just for you. And it goes like this. Buy British Telecom and we'll tell you you are loved. The British are so sophisticated. Are they so unintelligent, so stupid, so uneducated, they're going to go out and buy British Telecom because of the Hunchback of Notre Dame? Hold off your verdict. Let's go more local. Mr. Klein walks into the advertising agency. "Yes, Mr. Klein, how can I help you?" "I want my product across every state of America. I want every store with my product. My label should be worn by everyone." "Certainly, Mr. Klein, what are you selling?" "Underwear." "Uh-huh. How do you get a whole nation excited about underwear?" "Unless you're not selling underwear." Ah. So they came up with a brilliant concept. Black and white still photo. Do you know how much money they saved on full color processing? A black and white still photo depicting two messages. What are the two messages in every black and white still photo of Calvin Klein? Thank you. I'm not asking you to get too descriptive, but there are two messages. What are the two messages? You're very warm. Two messages. Number one, it's about to happen. Number two, it just did. Now, when you next look, don't look. But if you have someone who next looks, they'll tell you that those are the two messages depicted by every Calvin Klein. Do you think that that message might relate to a few hundred thousand million youngsters who are frustrated? I was once giving a lecture called When is Love Real? Calvin Klein meets King David. And there was a lady in the audience who came up to me at the end and said, Rabbi, my name is Donna, and I'm an attorney on Calvin Klein's budget. We have over 7 figures, and the commercials are made exactly as you described. That's exact intent. Are these commercials really working? Are people really buying products because of commercials? How much was Michael Jackson paid? Do you remember that Pepsi Cola commercial where the Pepsi was splashed across the screen? Remember that? Yeah? How much was Michael Jackson paid for 186 seconds of his precious time to wiggle his body in front of a camera? $11 million. I would have done it for half the price. Were the sales of Pepsi successful? Sony saw the marketing results of this commercial and signed Michael Jackson up for a 10-year contract for $2 billion. If you're not sure whether the commercials are working or not, ask again. I'll give you one more example, because it really hits home, because this one's really under the belt. This is First National Bank. You can carry on banking with First National. Okay, I'm not knocking the bank. First National Bank came up with the following commercial. You see a father, 40-year-old approximately, pinstripe suit, tie up to his neck, and he's running through a plush green meadow in slow motion to a beautiful signature tune, and you see the waves of wind blowing against the leaves, and two little children, a boy and a girl, maybe 5, 6 years old, running towards him, so cute, and you see them embrace right in the middle of the meadow, and just as they hug, across the screen goes deep American husky accent. I'm going to try and do. Caring fathers invest in First National Bank. End of commercial. Go to the script writing room. What are they really putting together over here? According to our statistics, Mr. 40-year-old plus, holds a very responsible position in his corporation. High salary, high commissions. Many people under his jurisdiction, he has earned their respect. He's building a second home, drives a cool car. Very impressed. But we looked at his heart and saw that he's unhappy. He's unhappy because he's riddled with guilt. He doesn't give enough time to his children. We felt so bad for him. We decided to come up with a commercial just for him. And it goes like this. Work longer hours so you can earn higher commissions and higher salary. Invest it in First National Bank for your children's future. And we will call you a caring father. Now I'm going to ask you honestly. There are people with PhDs, doctorates, intellectuals, professionals, business people, analysts. Who do the advertising agencies take us for? Do they really think that the public at large are buying products because of their commercials? And what do you think their honest answer is? If you ask Saatchi and Saatchi, if you ask a top advertising agency, do you really think we're buying your products because of your commercials? Do you know what their real answer is? Their honest answer, it's amazing. Their real answer is, we don't care if you don't buy our product because of our commercial, because you will anyway. Where do they get the arrogance to say that people are going to buy the product anyway? And the answer is in the following question. How many commercials has the average child in America seen before the age of 10? It's a very easy statistic to calculate. Figure out how many hours a child is home watching, how many commercials there are on the 2, 3, 4, 5 hours of TV. Statistically, a 10-year-old has seen approximately 250,000 commercials. Figure this out for a moment. 250,000 times a child saw happiness associated to a product. Being cool associated to the Marlboro Man. Pleasure. Alive with pleasure. Newport. Do you ever know that cigarette? You don't have it here? You go down the West Side Highway, Manhattan and you see this big billboard, alive with pleasure. You see this woman being catapulted into a man's arms and he's smoking Newport. Did you ever see someone go to a kiosk and buy Newport and start going, wedding? I never forget, I was in London about 9 years old, in Earl's Court, that's the Javits Center of England, and I used to go to the annual motor show. And I loved all the beautiful sports cars there, and it was really odd. On almost every sports car, there was a young lady in a suggestive position wearing a bikini. You know what the weather's like in London? I said to my father, Daddy, you know, if you write out a check for the car, do you get the... What is she doing on top of the car? English weather. They're not selling cars. They're selling emotional expectations of what will happen when I drive this car, smoke this cigarette, Virginia Slims. I'm supposed to feel slim. They're selling us on positive expectations. But the poison goes deeper than that. Because after I've bought a product because of the commercial, and it didn't really change me internally, I haven't become cool and happier, because it's not real, it's only artificial coloring, it's really not lasting. What happens after I'm driving the new Volvo, and 3 months later they come up with the next model? I remember that feeling of about 5 years ago I had a second-hand Volvo, it looked in perfect condition, and then the next year's model came out a few months later, and I felt inadequate. I felt genuinely inadequate. But there was nothing wrong with my car. What am I being sold on? That happiness is my choice to enjoy what's already in my life, and that becomes a training to enjoy future blessings. So I'll enjoy that too. But if I don't enjoy what's already good in my life, where's the logic that dictates that when I get more, then I'll be happy? Wait a minute, I'm not enjoying this. Why will more make me happy? Every commercial has that assumption. Is it any surprise that kids grow up so confused about love, pleasure, happiness, success, when we've got such competition, rewiring their minds? What the advertising agencies essentially are saying is that if we've had the kid till 10, we have wired their minds up to associate the deepest cravings of the heart, the mind, the intellect, and the soul to lifestyle and products. And yet when we ask the question, what really counts in life? How much we have? Or how we use it? How much money we make? Or how we earn it and how we share it? And how responsible we are with it? How many people love me? Or how much we give appreciation and love to others? And then the law of reciprocation kicks in because they feel loved and appreciated. They want to give back. I'll share with you an unexpected competitor, the educational system. And I don't say what I'm about to share with you as an evaluation. I'm not here to put down the educational system. I just want to share this on an observational level. And that is, in the educational system, where is the emphasis on how well my kid gets along with the other kids socially and integrates well with them? Fun-loving, playing well, adapts well with the teacher's instructions, cooperates? Or is it basically the report card? Where is the emphasis? On the grade A or on how well-adjusted my child is emotionally? We know that the report card, the grade A, is basically what we're paying the school fees for. So let me ask you, what happens where a child is gifted? And this happened to me many times because most of my work has been with gifted children. And grandma comes in, asks a complicated question to her son, and grandchild, 7, 8 years old, answers right there. Oh, you're a genius, you're Einstein, you're so brilliant! And mom and dad are so proud of you, and the teachers say such good things. What is the measure in the child's mind of why they're good? Why they're admired? Why are they recognized? Why are they valuable? Why are they validated? For their mind, their brain, their intellect, their intelligence, their short-term memory, long-term memory, their ability to analyze and give clear-cut clarity. But let me ask you, What is the real measure of success? Is it how brilliant we are? How many letters at the end of our name in the corporate world? What position we hold? How high our salary? Or do we really know that deep down the real measure of success is how well we get along in our relationships with other people at work, with the co-workers, the client, that difficult boss, that difficult mother-in-law, that difficult parent, that difficult child, with our spouse? We know that the real measure for our own selves is how we get along and take care of ourselves and those most important closest to us. What's now been coined as the emotional intelligence, sensitivity, love, appreciation, kindness, respect, giving, gratitude, ability to apologize, recognize I made a mistake, I wronged you, I hurt you, and to feel sorry and say sorry. This is where it's really at. So we find now that we are at an amazing disadvantage. The educational system is telling our child that you have to do well, and that's basically the measure. You're going to do well, son. You're going to do well, my dear daughter, because of your grades. And we've got the competition of the media. And this brings us to number four. What chance do we have of being so clear in communicating to our child the real version of love or happiness or financial responsibility or health, spousing, raising kids, getting along with other people, integrity in the workplace, all the things that we mentioned, being a mensch, when we've got such competition which is so compelling and promising immediate gratification, how can we expect our child, who's pulled and torn with such competition, to come back to our store later on and say, you are right. This version is real. How can we so clearly communicate the ingredients in our jars, in our products? I want to share with you the following possible answer, which is right under our noses. And it doesn't require a PhD in parenting. It's found in Deuteronomy 6. See, I got to it in the end, right? I'm a religious fanatic too. Deuteronomy 6. You know what it says there? The mission statement of the Jewish people, the Shema Yisrael. And in that statement, we have a 4-point plan for parenting. Right under our noses. Let's look at it carefully because it will reveal to us very empowering strategies. It says there, Veshinantam levanecha, teach this to your children. Veshinantam in Hebrew also means sheni, which means repeat again and again. Chew it over. Go over this again and again. Vedibarta bam, speak with them. Communicate with them. Talk with them. Describe the world that you and I see as adults, as parents, as the adult references in their lives. Explain the world to them. Explain the clarity, the distinctions between right and wrong, real and false, good and bad. Vidibatabam, and watch the 4-point plan unfold. How are we supposed to communicate to our children? Beshivtecha beveitecha, when you sit in your home. Look at the words. How you and I sit in our homes is how we communicate to our children. How we relax, or how we're still unwinding. How we come home, what we do to relax. What programs we watch, what we don't watch. What we will listen to, what we won't listen to. What principles we have or what principles we don't have. Or non-principles. How we act in the home, how we live, b'shivtecha beveitecha, how we live in our home. The word shav, any Israelis in the audience? Shav means live, sit, and it can also mean respond. We're going to look at all three. How we live in our home, how we relax in our home. How we report the world around us to our spouse and our children is how we parent our kids, how we communicate to our children the values that we live that are on the jars in our store. How happy am I after a financial loss on the stock market? What are my true assets? Am I so attached to the money I make and the possessions I have worked hard for that I am devastated when I lose a large amount of money? Or does my child see that even if I have lost a lot of money, even on a reasonably safe investment, or a private investment, or whichever investment, they see that we hold strong. Because our true assets, health, children, happy marriage, how much is that worth? How much is our health worth? How much are our eyes worth? Extended family, I still have a job. Am I keeping inventory? And when my kid sees that we've got a medical setback, God forbid, and it's real, it can and does happen. How do we respond in the home to what we go through? Our child sees, and that's our commercial to our child. How we respond to the world around us in the home. How we respond to the differences between our spouse and ourselves. The differences that come up between us becomes a message to our child. What's real happiness in a marriage? How similar we are and how less dissimilar we are? Is that what's going to really make a happy marriage? Well, perhaps in an ideal state, yes. But is it true that the real measure of happiness in a relationship is not how similar we are? Because we can never anticipate all the differences that will come up that we could never have expected. It's impossible. You marry someone for their positive, upbeat attitude, and their father, who they hated and had a very bad relationship, dies, and your wife falls apart. But darling, I don't understand. One of the things that attracted me to you is you're so upbeat and so happy all the... Why are you so devastated? 6 months already. Why are you feeling such a loss? You weren't even talking to the man. You don't understand, darling. I realize now that I never had a healing relationship. I'm broken. Can you and I really anticipate the differences that might come into a relationship? It's impossible to know that the husband who has staying power and was working with this company for 9 years gets laid off and falls into depression. But darling, one of the things I married you for is your security and your staying power. Why are you still so... Get yourself... Look at the classification... Get a job, move. How could I know? I can't know everything. We're going to have differences in how to raise the children, where to live, where to go on vacation. Can we anticipate all that? What's going to be the real measure? How similar we are, how less different we are, or how we manage the differences? As two adults communicating with respect, with a gentle voice, not raised voices. How much our children see anger or control of it, struggling with our own personal growth in the home. How you and I live in the home is our commercial to our child. And b'shivtecha bevitecha is a play on words, because the word shav also means respond. Sha'alot u'tshuvot, questions and answers. How we answer each other, how we answer our child, how we answer our spouse, how we answer the phone, how we don't answer the phone, how we talk about extended family and what we will not say about them, is our lesson to our children. It's our commercial to our kids that's communicating our values. We have a lot of power. Every single encounter with our child is a snapshot. And it enters the two stereo microphones on each side of their face, and it stays in there until they have the emotional vocabulary to describe it to themselves later on. After 15 years of therapy, I mean when they get teenagers, and they understand what they went through, our children pick up on everything. The word shevet, in esoteric ruling, you're allowed to play around. On the mystical level of Judaism, you can take the letters which sound the same and interchange them, so that the taf and the tet can be interchanged, so that shevet It doesn't mean sitting in your home. It means the rod of discipline. Shevet is a rod of discipline. B'shivtecha beveitecha would then read how you discipline in the home. How strong is our yes? How strong is our no? Son, I told you already, no! Oh, please, Mama, I promise I'll be your best friend. I'll do my homework. Just give me 5 more minutes of TV. Please, I beg you, Mommy. All right. Now, there's no one who can relate to this. Some of you have friends know what I'm talking about, but let me ask you, if my no is not a real no, what have I taught my child in terms of the ingredients? Thank you. What have I taught my child in terms of the ingredients of what's real discipline? What's real self-control? What does the world outside our home sell as freedom? Do what you want, as much as you want, with whom you want, as many times as you want, as wherever you want. That's the ultimate freedom, surely. I mean, can there be a greater level of freedom than that? Or is that actually a description of slavery to lust and cravings? Let me ask you. When we say no to a second cookie, do we experience slavery or freedom? Come on, men, you know the answer. What? Real answer? You bet! When we say no, and we feel stronger for it, we feel slim for it, we say no to the wrong thing and say right to the yes thing, we feel freedom of being in control. Real freedom is being in control of oneself. Being out of control, allowing myself anything, is not freedom. It's out of control. I never forget, in one audience, there was a man who got up and said, I want to tell you the greatest thing my father ever did for me is when I was 16 years old and I was taken to the police station because I was caught in a motorbike accident and I was drunk. And I called Dad at 2 o'clock in the morning and asked him to please come pick me up. And Dad said, where are you, son? Dad, I'm in the police station. Good, stay there. And he put the phone down on me. And I hated him for it. I spent the night in jail. But afterwards, I realized he did the best thing in my life. He taught me that he's not going to bail me out for my mistakes. That I had to learn to live with the consequences of my choice. When we say no and we say yes, we're creating the limitations for what's permitted and what's not permitted in our child's references so that they can learn what's right and what's wrong. So how strong are we there when the world is selling freedom is unlimited? You can do any which way you want with as many as who with any way you want. That's the first of the four. The second one is uvelechtecha v'derech, when we go outside the home. When we go on a journey, how we design the vacation, how we go through the toll booth, how we say hello to the guy in the toll booth. Hi, how you doing? Thank you for the change. Have a good day. Or just ignore the man. In the Talmud, they have an interesting question. How do you steal from someone who has nothing? How do you steal from someone who's totally destitute? He owns nothing. How can you steal from him? So the Talmud answers, if you have a poor man who gives you a greeting, and you don't respond, what did I just do? I stole the one thing he does have, his dignity. Our sages tell us that a smile is so important that they decided to allow for what appears to be a violation of the Decalogue. The Ten Commandments says, don't take my name in vain. And the sages said that we were losing grip of giving a hearty greeting to a stranger, even to a friend. And so they said, say God's name in a greeting. That's how important it is to greet another person. Why? Let me ask you. You're going in the street, someone who you know across the street, you wave, hi. Oh, hi. How are you going? Fine. Have a good day. Yes, see you. Now let me ask you, we're intelligent people. How much did you and I gain from that exchange? Are we wiser? Doesn't it behoove intelligent human beings just to go by and ignore the other person? But what really happens is, when I say hello, how are you? It's a great accomplishment because I recognize your existence in my life. Every time we come home, hug our spouse and child. Darling, my lovely daughter, my beautiful son, my precious one. how are you today? Even if it's 3 seconds and we're on the phone and looking at the correspondence, the hug and the smile and the kiss is a big message. You exist in my life. I recognize you. Never let go of the power of a greeting. It's not small. It's simply profound. So tell our sages, when we go out of the house, how we greet others is a commercial to our child. When our child sees how we interact with other people. How we are in the workplace. How we get along with the cashier at the register. Where there's a misunderstanding. How do we deal with the complaint to the manager in the store. All these are the experiences which add up to commercials. Still photos, full color, and they're played back full 3-dimension videotape in the mind of a child. These are memories we're giving our children. And the last two we had living at home, going outside the home. And the last two is uvashachbecha, how we lie down. How we go to bed at night with our child. I can't believe it's 8:45, you've done your homework, you're still watching television, you've got your pajamas on, my life doesn't get till 9 o'clock at night. Now I know there's no one in the audience who can relate to this, but some of you have friends and neighbors who know what I'm talking about. How we get our kids to bed at night. What words we say, the Shema Yisrael, we remind them of what are the values that we live for and that our parents have died for. The stories, there's such an explosion of Judaica in the stores of righteous individuals throughout the generations that we can call upon. Personal accounts of survival of parents from the Holocaust, grandparents. Personal accounts of how you were in school and how you went through a difficult time. And they tell that story over to one's child. Have you noticed how family stories click with the kid in such a way, please, mommy, tell me that story again, and you've only said it 500 times? Because the child understands, even though they don't have the emotional vocabulary to explain, the child understands that this story about mommy, daddy, grandma, grandpa, is a reference to my identity. That's who I want to continue in the footsteps of. That is a principle of integrity, or survival, or faith, or love, or kindness, or generosity, or giving, or being a mensch. That's part of my family. That's where I come from. That's what I'm about. That's what I'm committed to becoming. They don't spell it that way as children, but that's why it's meaningful to them, because we are painting the references of their personality and who they want to become in their emotional strength, their personal growth, their health. And the last one, uvkumecha, how we get up in the morning. I can't believe you missed the bus again! It's 9 o'clock! You haven't got your sneakers on your hands and your backside! You haven't finished your breakfast! My life doesn't begin till 9 a.m. No one can relate to this. How we get our kids up in the morning is all about us controlling our emotions. It's all about us being disciplined. Can they just leave their beds so that we clean up after them? Can they just leave their cereal unfinished on the table, run out for the bus for mommy, daddy, slave and maidservant to clear up? How we get our kids to bed at night, how we rise in the morning, how we get up from adversity, how we see through a difficult relationship or a divorce. Sometimes that's a reality. But who we become after the divorce is by far the greater measure of whether we'll have a continuing relationship with this child. Am I going to be bitter against my spouse and blame and put down and badmouth to my kid, the other mother, father? Or am I going to find the inner strength to be kind, gracious, loving about them and become a stronger me? And in that way, earn my child's respect. It makes no difference the intensity of the adversity or challenges or suffering or pain that we go through. Ultimately, the real test of how strongly we communicated inner strength to our child will be how we get up after a difficult time in our lives, whether it was a medical setback, financial setback, relationship setback. It's how you and I stand up to adversity that's our reference to our child. I began this presentation with the suggestion that it's a pity that we only write our bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah speeches for our kids, but not the eulogy, not the speech at our funeral. But I think that's not correct. Because every encounter with our child in the home, outside the home, every time we have them in the morning and the evening, we are writing the scripts of our lives that will be the memories that our children will have with them after we're no longer here. And the child will be saying, when they go through a difficult relationship, how did mum handle this? How would dad have handled this? How did mum take that news from the doctor of that dangerous disease? How did dad handle losing that job? How did mum relate to a difficult parent-in-law? How strong were they in their compassion and love and attention to me as a child when they go through a difficulty with your grandchild? And it's never too late. It's never too late to start again, because no matter how much we messed up, we always have a second chance through the grandchildren. They're going to want you to babysit them, and you'll be able to communicate what you want with that kid. And let me ask you honestly, if I spent 20 or 30 years in rage and anger, and I raised my kids with rage and anger, and then I decide that I'm going to work on my anger for the next however long it takes, and it takes me 10, 20, 30 years to be in complete control of my emotions. Let's say it takes me from 30 till 60, struggling with my rage, my low frustration. And from the age of 60 to, let's say, 85, a good 25 years. My children and grandchildren always see grandpa or grandma, nothing will get them upset. They will not be judgmental. They'll still be loving and compassionate. And they will not hurt me because I made a mistake. And even if I let them down, they find something good about me instead of getting angry. What will be left behind after 85 years old and we pass on? The first 60 years of 30 years of rage and 30 years of struggle? You should have told me. Or will they remember the last 25 years? That no matter what hell let loose around them, no matter what chaos, mum, dad held their strength and didn't get angry. Would it be worth the 30 years of struggling to get to 25 years of being in control? It's never too late, even if we messed up. I'm going to end off on the following. Three mothers boasting to themselves on Broadwalk. They're telling each other how much their son shows them respect on their birthday. Mrs. Kuschlewski is boasting to Mrs. Horowitz, is boasting to Mrs. Cohen. And Mrs. Kuschlewski says, you know, you want I should tell you what my son does for me on my birthday? You don't want to know, but I tell you anyway. My son on my birthday, oh, you cannot imagine. I hear a knock on the door. I go to the door. Oh, my son, how are you? Mommy, happy birthday! Whoosh, give me such a hug, it's going to destroy my ribs. I open my eyes, in the end of the driveway, this big limousine, stretch limousine. How they stretch it, I don't know. My son takes me to the limo, to Manhattan, to the most expensive kosher restaurant in Manhattan. And they're waiting for me. All my friends and relatives, we have a party for my birthday, this is my son. And she turns to Mrs. Horowitz. How does your son show you respect on your birthday? Ah, you don't want to know, but I tell you anyway. My son! My son, I hear a knock on the door. Mom, happy birthday! He takes me in a limo to Kennedy Airport. And he puts me on the Concorde. And 2 hours and 52 minutes later, I arrive in London. And there, he taxis me to the Ritz Hotel. Do you know the Ritz? Only kings and princes and princesses. He takes me to the Ritz. I come inside the hotel, he's waiting for me. There, all my friends and relatives from the whole world. We had a weekend party. This is my father, my birthday. It's so special. And they both turn to Mrs. Cohen. Everyone knows. I'm springing over there. Everyone knows. I'm going to shout afterwards. Everyone knows that Mrs. Cohen has zero relationship. Minus her, she hasn't been talking with her son for decades. And Mrs. Cohen, how does your son show you respect on your birthday? Oh, my son. My son doesn't have to wait for no birthday to show me respect. My son, he pays $175 an hour, 5 times a week to his therapist. And all he talks about is me. I'm going to give you a 1-800 number of the ultimate therapist, 1-800 Almighty. When it's going hard, please God, help me. Help me have clarity with this child, with this mouse. Help me to realize that who I am already as I am now is my commercial to my child. I'm parenting my kid by default. Before I go to any parenting class or anything else, who I am in my financial responsibility, who I am in how I take care of my health, who I am in my religious values, principles, who I am in my integrity in the workplace, how I'm responsible with finances, how I am in personal growth, is my commercial to my child. And this is the greatest communication to our children. Raising kids is really about raising ourselves. And what's beautiful is you have here the Columbus Kollel and the Jewish Family Services coming together for the sake of clarity on parenting. There are many services available, and the classes as well, to help us to grow in our values as Jews. Clarity on parenting. There are many services available, and the classes as well, to help us to grow in our values as